Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us. We are now going to take you into the courtroom for the motion hearing, part one of Brian Koberger. In this part of the hearing that took place on Friday, the 18th of 2023, prosecutors argued they can't provide something that doesn't exist, as Koberger's attorney requested additional DNA evidence. Let's go to the courtroom for this segment of testimony.
All right. So if I'm understanding your question there, or your assertion, that we're talking about three potential analysis of DNA that was not provided to you, but that has no connection to Mr. Koberger.
Correct.
Any response?
Your Honor, we didn't realize this was going to be an issue today. We had given the defense everything that we received from the lab. They'd asked for DNA workups on other people. To the extent that they don't have them, they weren't done. We can't produce something that doesn't exist. We provided everything. There's one outstanding lab report that relates to the forensic examination by the lab personnel of the crime scene itself that will be received today. That's the only outstanding lab report. Everything else, along with all the notes, is what there is, and it's been provided to defense. And if they're hoping that there's something else there, it's not there.
Taylor?
Well, Your Honor, it's part of our third motion to compel. It's still something that we don't have. We also don't have the unexpected corrective actions, unexpected results from the Idaho State Police Forensics Lab for the 6 months before and the 6 months after November 13th, 2022. We did get some, but it's a narrow scope, and we asked for the full year, 6 months before and 6 months after. That's also in our motion.
I understand your responsibility is to turn over every rock. But you can't get things that don't exist as well. So, I mean, there has to be some level of trust in discovery. You're all sworn attorneys. And so Mr. Thompson was saying that there's one more lab report that is coming your way today, I heard him say.
Not, maybe not today. We are waiting to receive it so that we can process it for discovery. It's supposed to be in any time.
Okay. I misunderstood that. So it's coming soon. It has to come soon because we're 6 weeks away from the trial. So we're going to be very rushed about a lot of things. But I'm going to talk about that a little more later, too. So what about the other claim, Mr. Thompson? Do you want to address that? The other mistakes?
Corrective action log, unexpected result log. We have that in part, but not
the I don't know what exists that we haven't received. We provided all the requests to the lab, and they've assured us that they have provided us with everything that they have within the scope of those requests. I'm not sure what else to say. I mean, we can make a supplemental inquiry to clarify that after we finish the report today. But I'm kind of sitting here saying, Judge, just give me everything we know to exist.
Well, that would be wise to check on that.
We will.
Because we don't want this to come back on the eve of trial.
Yes, sir.
Or, you know, 4 years from now at an appeal.
Yes, sir.
So we want to make sure that we have combed through all the information that has any bearing or argument of bearing on this case.
Jing is making a note right now. We'll send the inquiry out later today.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Your Honor, just for a point of clarification, we also ask for all emails, text messages, a lot of electronic messages or other messages. And some have been provided, but we don't have assurance that that's all. And so for the same reason, we want to make sure that we have the complete file.
Okay, Mr. Thompson.
We have told them, we have given them everything that we know to exist. We've asked the lab provided it to us, and sent it to them. At this point, all I'm hearing is speculation is they think maybe or they wish something else was there. But as far as we know, it doesn't exist. I don't know what else we can say. You can't respond to something that isn't real. Sorry, Judge.
I mean, we're just sorting it out.
Yes, sir.
Making sure that everything that there is shared.
We'll
except for the ones that you don't want to
absolutely
share.
Yes, sir.
And that's one of the reasons we're here.
We'll make an additional inquiry to the lab to see if there's anything else in the form of emails that they haven't already provided to us.
I would add, I mean, there are times, okay, in the world of the law, that sometimes people forget to do things, or sometimes things fall through the cracks, and so it's always healthy to make sure that it is done thoroughly.
Absolutely. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
You're now ready to call Steve Mercer.
Okay. Are your experts in the courtroom right now?
Yeah.
Do they need to be in the courtroom?
Your Honor, I ask that they be allowed to remain in the courtroom, seated where they are, so they're just kind of alone.
Right. Any objection to that? I don't know who to point to here.
Sure, we don't have a witness.
I'm going to exclude your witnesses so they're not hearing what the other witnesses are testifying by, and that will be, I think, a cleaner and more accurate response. And I don't want to have them reacting to the other testimony. We'll hear each testimony or each witness's testimony be. Okay, so if you please have your other experts excluded from the courtroom.
Where would the court like them to go? This is a media intensive environment, and I don't want them to be bothered by the media as long as they go.
The law library.
May I escort them there?
Sure. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Mercer. Okay, Ms. Mercer, thank you. Please raise your right hand.
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you give in this case shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury?
I do. Thank you, Ms. Mercer. Go ahead and get some water there. I'll take care of that. And once you're seated, could you please state your name and spell your last?
Yes, my name is Stephen with PH Mercer, M-E-R-C-E-R.
All right, thank you, sir. Okay, Ms. Taylor.
Good morning, Mr. Mercer.
Good morning.
What city and state are you from?
Rockville, Maryland.
What do you do for work?
I am a licensed attorney in Maryland and the District of Columbia. in the field of criminal defense with the area specialization in DNA and forensic litigation.
How long have you been an attorney?
I was licensed in the state of Maryland in 1995 and in the District of Columbia in 1997. I'm also the member of several federal bars, including the Supreme Court, where I appeared as co-counsel of Maryland v. King, a DNA database case from 2013, as well as the Fourth Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, and a number of federal district courts.
I want to back up a little bit and have you tell me about your educational background.
So I have an undergraduate degree, bachelor's degree in English from Syracuse University, 1984. Juris Doctor JD from the District of Columbia School of Law from 1994.
And you mentioned you have a specialty in DNA. What does that come from?
So my experience with DNA began with the first constitutional challenge to Maryland's DNA database statute, and that started in 2002 in the case of State v. Raines, where it raised a Fourth Amendment challenge to the compelled collection of DNA from convicted offenders, prevailed on that case in the trial court. It was appealed to the Court of Appeals, which is now called the Maryland Supreme Court. The Maryland Supreme Court, in a sharply divided 4-3 decision, reversed, sent it back for trial, tried the case, and that was really the beginning of my experience with forensic DNA litigation. And then from that point, I continued in that field, attended training with the District of Columbia Public Defender Service. I began to collaborate with the Innocence Project and the Forensics Division at the Maryland Office of the Public Defender, doing indigent defense work and innocence work, and began to work closely with DNA scientists who actually did the wet chemistry work, had numerous opportunities to tour law enforcement labs, including the NIST lab, as well as Montgomery County's lab, Bode Technology, the FBI lab, as well. And so I continued working in the field, providing both direct representation in DNA cases as well as consultation through my private practice. And then in 2010, the public defender recruited me to head up the forensics division at Maryland's Office of the Public Defender, which is a statewide public defender system. And then there, I really dived much deeper into the field of DNA forensic litigation at that time. And if there's some questions, I can explain that further.
I may ask you some others about that in just a moment. And will you tell me about any publications in the articles that you
made? Yes, so I published an article, co-authored an article of Maryland's DNA Data Bank back in the early 2000s following the State v. Raines decision. I also published an article in the, it was the NYU's Law Review about shadow DNA databanks with a co-author, Jessica Grable, and those are the principal articles with respect to forensic DNA.
And I think you mentioned a couple of professional organizations that you belong to. Are there others?
Yes, so I'm a member of the jurisprudential section of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and I've given presentations there. For example, in 2018, I gave a presentation on proposed regulation of the field of forensic genealogy. And then I'm also a member of the National Criminal Defense Attorneys Association and a number of local bar associations in Maryland, as well as the State Bar Association.
You mentioned forensic genetic genealogy just now. Can you tell me your background and your age?
So, following really the advent of forensic genealogy in 2018, That is when I had the opportunity to litigate cases, criminal cases involving that technique, the testing and the investigation related to the testing, and to receive discovery of the testing and the interpretation of the test results that were obtained through searching of genetic data banks.
You are here on Brian Kroeberger's case. How did you involve him?
Yeah, so the question was, what would a reasonable defense attorney do when confronted with DNA evidence that needs to be litigated? What are the minimum practice standards? So I'm not here to discuss Idaho's discovery rules or offer legal opinions about constitutional standards. Rather, my area of focus is based on my experience, training, and expertise in forensic DNA litigation, and what a minimum practice standard would be for a reasonably competent trial attorney who must comply with their duty to investigate a case on behalf of their client.
And is that because what you get when you get genetic genealogy materials?
Well, yes. I mean, forensic evidence is often central in a case, and DNA evidence in particular. And so when there's an item, for example, here of an environmental sample of trace DNA evidence that, as I understand it from reviewing the pleadings, was twice tested, first for an STR profile and then later for a genomic profile, the question becomes, what is the minimum practice standard for an attorney to be effective in your representation of a client given that type of evidence?
When you're talking about two samples happening, or two tests happening, why should an attorney know about that?
Well, there are a number of reasons why it's crucial for the attorney to investigate any testing of evidence that is central to a case. And again, here it's an environmental sample of trace DNA that is being tested. It's essential for the attorney to know, for a number of reasons, about the details of the testing and the investigation when we're talking specifically about forensic genealogy. Number one is there's pretrial concerns, and those pretrial concerns that can be raised would involve suppression issues and potentially Fourth Amendment issues. These are questions that are very much evolving in the state of our litigation, but to understand the viability of a Fourth Amendment challenge, there has to be a factual investigation. There has to be a determination of the conduct that law enforcement undertook during the forensic analysis of the genealogy. So, for example, was it fast and loose? Was there searching of data banks that violated the terms and conditions of those data banks? Was there surreptitious DNA collection from individuals, targeted individuals in family trees? So these are very fact-specific inquiries that the attorney must know in formulating a suppression challenge under the Fourth Amendment, because it's all about reasonable expectations of privacy. And what's really critical here to understand, and this is close to me from my litigation, early on the government and law enforcement's argument was always there are minimal privacy interests at stake because forensic DNA profile is like a fingerprint, and it says nothing about who the person is. But now, with forensic genealogy, we're talking about genomic profiles, potentially whole genomic profiles, or at the very least, a SNP profile, single nucleotide polymorphism profile. I'm sorry, single nucleotide polymorphism. An SNP profile that contains a vast amount of information that is very, very private. And so this is a real game changer in the privacy interests that are at stake and that the attorney needs to understand in investigating the case to assess and to evaluate that suppression issue, that Fourth Amendment issue. So that's one issue pretrial. There's also concerns about reliability. And by reliability, I'm not talking necessarily about the forensic genomic profile, but I'm talking about the STR profile. And again, because as I understand it from the pleadings, there were multiple tests on the same evidence, environmental sample of trace DNA. One produced a STR profile that I understand from the pleadings is represented as being a single source male profile. The reliability of that needs to be investigated, and certainly through one aspect of that is investigating the laboratory documentation that is provided for the STR testing. But we also have to appreciate, and again, I'm not a DNA scientist or a biologist, but I'm an attorney that works with experts, and I need to know what type of expert to hire. And one thing that I do realize in looking at this is when there's multiple tests of the same piece of evidence, and you have a genomic profile, in other words, potentially the entire human genome that is typed from this environmental sample of trace DNA, or at least an SNP profile, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 700,000 locations of data. What does that tell us about the STR profile markers? So for example, the STR profile markers, which are typed, are 20 out of 30,000 STR markers overall. And so what I would be investigating with a qualified expert is, number one, I don't know from the pleadings if there's a whole genome profile that's been developed for the forensic genealogy, but if there is, that should contain STR markers. What did that tell us about the reliability of the STR testing? Is there any potential for artifacts? Is there any potential for an undetected low-level mixture? Those types of questions that are potentially available to inquire and ask about where you have multiple tests of the same piece of evidence and it's an environmental sample of trace DNA. Now, if it's just an SNP profile, I say yes, but that's 700,000 locations of information that is like a probabilistic future diary of someone's health, medical, and all manner of conditions that are linked to genetics. That may not have the STR markers in it itself, but it will have information SNP markers in the neighborhood of, so to speak, of STR markers that will also shed light potentially on those STR markers and the reliability of those STR markers. So these are, particularly in a capital case, crucial areas of inquiry that must be undertaken by the defense team in conjunction with experts that they retain. But they can't even decide what experts to retain without having the discovery. And that's the minimum practice standard. And that's a point that I've made in testimony before, where I've been accepted as an expert in Maryland, DC, and Virginia, that the minimum practice standard is that the attorney must obtain discovery of the scientific testing of an evidence sample. And that, particularly so in a capital case, and particularly where we're talking about an environmental sample of trace DNA, is absolutely crucial to get that discovery, because then that informs the scope of the investigation, the experts to hire, and what have you. Now, also, with respect to the forensic genealogy, it's important not to separate this out into all these different components. It is, you have the S&P testing, and then you also have the development of these family trees through database searching. This is all part of the same testing and experiment. They go really hand in hand, and you can't unravel them. They really have to be considered together as a single core of different strands of the testing and experiment, because the attorney needs to know how these family trees have been developed, because we're talking now about trial issues, and the government is introducing the STR profile. They have to introduce statistics that explain the significance of any STR match that the government is identifying as central to its case. And so the defense must investigate ways to cross-examine those statistics and the rarity of that match that the government is attaching great significance to. An area to look into and to inquire about are the limits of the statistical tool that the government is using, or the state is using, which is based on the premise that sort of what's called a random person not excluded, and that's answering the question of the rarity of a profile in a population of unrelated people. But the key point there is unrelated. So we know there's no universe where a STR profile has no relatives. And in fact, in a case involving forensic genealogy, the way that the defendant is identified is by searching a pool of related people. And so we need to be able to investigate and evaluate the rarity of a profile within a related population. And that's a different question than what the government answers with its random person not excluded statistic that is typically used. And so, again, without the discovery of the forensic genealogy, both the testing as well as the experiments that are done with the test results, i.e. the database searches, as well as the family tree build-out, the attorney can't investigate that. In that situation, by not investigating it, is not complying with their duty to investigate that is required, especially in a capital case.
I've heard you say that when you have a sample, in this case, it would be a new sample from a man, that an STR has been done. And then when you go when you have genetic genealogy testing, you end up with a whole genome testing or an SNP profile. Did I understand that?
Yes, and it's unclear to me at this point what type of genomic profile was developed, whether it was a whole genome sequence or whether it was an SNP profile, which contains about 700,000 locations of very personal information.
I think I heard you say that no matter which one of those were done for genetic genealogy, that you need to look at those to test the reliability of the STR profile. Did I hear that right?
Yes. So this is, as an attorney, and not a scientist, but as an attorney who has a duty to investigate, this now is an area where the attorney will look to retain a qualified expert who can evaluate and assess the linkages between an SNP profile or a whole genomic profile and an STR profile. To be sure, an SNP profile or forensic genomic profile can't be searched in CODIS. It's not that type of situation. It can't be directly compared. But there are techniques that can evaluate if it is a whole genomic profile. You would look to a scientist, then would be targeting the areas of the whole genomic profile that comprise the STR profile, to then evaluate the reliability of the STR profile, the potential for any mixture, the potential for any artifacts in the STR profile. Or if it's an SNP profile which doesn't have the STR locations in it, then you would look for an expert who understands that the neighboring regions around where the STR markers can be evaluated and assessed to provide information about what the STR markers could be.
So what you're saying is that you need to look at the qualified scientists. We have to look at the SNP profile to compare it to the STP profile for the reliability of the STP profile.
The STR profile.
STR.
Yeah, so there could be clues, absolutely, that could be discerned from an analysis of the SNP or whole genomic profile. Because again, we're talking about two different tests of the same piece of evidence. And there have been, in peer-reviewed publication, I mean, one that comes to mind is Jae-Hwa Kim, who published in the journal Cell about how there can an SNP profile can be linked to an STR, is STR profile. And that's by zeroing in on sort of the neighboring regions and examining those. So again, I'm not a biologist or scientist, but I'm an attorney, you know, who has a duty to investigate, and to investigate requires hiring experts to examine this data, this discovery that hasn't been released yet. And so that's why the minimum practice standard is to get that discovery so that the attorney can then assess that discovery and then retain a qualified scientist to help understand the extent to which the SNP testing will shed light on the reliability of the STR testing that has already been done on the same piece of evidence.
So that having that profile on the SNP can verify the legitimacy of the STR.
Right. So that's my hypothesis. That's what I go to the expert to inquire about. Because again, this is a very much an emerging area of forensic science and litigation.
Sure.
I don't believe that this witness is qualified to opine on what's needed in these scientific processes. He just indicated that it was his personal hypothesis. I would renew my objection to that.
Well, I'm going to overrule that because I asked any questions. I apologize. Go ahead, ask your next question.
When I'm talking about either the whole genome or the SNP profile, am I looking for just like a sheet of paper that has a bunch of numbers on it, or is there a packet of information that I need to go to my expert?
No, you need the raw data of the profile along with, it's similar to the sort of data that you obtain for the SDR test. You get the raw data of the profile, you get the laboratory protocols, you get all the bench notes, how the profile was generated, but also you should get the discovery about how the profile was then searched in different databases and family trees constructed.
That was going to be my next question. I heard you say that we can't look at this whole genome sequencing or the SNP in one category and then look at the building the tree to identify from the genetic genealogy piece, the genealogist piece, in its own separate area. They're not two separate lanes that they combine.
Yes, they go hand in hand. You do one or the other. I mean, they go together.
Why?
I'm sorry?
Can you tell me why? Can you explain why you say they go together, why you go?
Well, the SNP profile was searched in the ancestry database to then identify potential relatives, and then family trees are built out. That's the object of the SNP testing. What's important to know from a defense perspective in terms of trial work and potential areas of cross-examination, the government is going to be introducing a statistic that is premised on the assumption of an unrelated
unrelated universe of people. So how, what's the chance of finding a profile in a population where there's no relationship relatedness between that profile and anyone in that universe? And so, as you know from talking about this whole concept of friendship genealogy, people who are related have similar DNA. And so the statistics change when you are talking about the chance of finding a profile within a related pool or related universe of individuals. And that's a legitimate area of inquiry from cross-examination for the defense to demonstrate the limitations of the statistical questions that the state is presenting to its expert witness. And to do that, you need to know, for example, who the population of related people are, who is often, from my work on the forensic genealogy, what I've seen is that when a match is found, when the STR match is found, then all building out, all further testing stops on the forensic genealogy side. And so it's important to know who hasn't been tested on the related person side in terms of developing cross-examination about the limitations of the statistical tool that the state uses in its case to demonstrate the rarity of the match that you're presenting.
Have you received medical genealogy materials in your case?
Yes, so, which wasn't surprising to me, because even though typically the government doesn't seek to introduce the forensic genealogy in its case, it nevertheless is evidence that is a scientific test of material in the case. And so, the discovery rules typically call, and for example, in Maryland, in the District of Columbia, call for discovery of scientific testing of evidence in a case, and that's regardless of whether the government is going to introduce it or not. DC is a little different, where it requires either a materiality showing or that the item is introduced into evidence. And so even when there's a limitation on the item being introduced into evidence, that really goes to the item tested, which here is the environmental sample of trace DNA. And of course, the government has twice tested it. And so for the attorney to be able to fulfill their duty to investigate and satisfy the minimum practice standards, they should have access to the scientific testing of that item of evidence, which is central to the case.
Isn't just 1 minute? Thank you. Mr. Messer, I don't have any other questions. I'm going to be hanging on in just a minute to prosecute.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I have no questions for this witness. Mr. Knight will be making our rebuttal arguments.
Okay, thank you. Okay, may this witness be excused?
Mm-hmm.
Any objection?
No objection.
Okay. You're excused.
That concludes part one of the motion hearing of Brian Koberger, taking place on the 18th of August 2023. There is more to come. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of that right here. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.